Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with the executive editor of Newsbusters, your host, Tim Graham.
Hello and welcome to the latest Newsbusters podcast from the weird, wild world of Joe Biden hiding from the occasion on 9/11 so people didn't question his Afghanistan fiasco. Sunday's Washington Post had a story buried inside the paper with the very helpful headline, Biden quietly marks milestone anniversary of 9/11 attacks. They reported both that Biden was leading a day of national mourning, but, quote, deliberately stayed in the background. Does this mean he was leading from behind? It was a solemn day for the country, but there were occasions here for Biden gaffe hunting. Start with a picture of Biden screaming at someone with his mask on his chin. This is a Getty photo, and this was must have been in New York, because you could see Barack Obama looking at him like, buddy. Then did you see the adorable picture of the president with kids at the memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania? Some of them were wearing MAGA hats or Trump hats. You know that the Democrats looked at that and went, nope! Biden was also found complaining about how people now have signs that say F Biden, or people yell it. This is happening again, happened again over the weekends at college football stadiums. And so he was complaining because he thinks this kind of rude commentary about him, it's just not who we are as Americans.
I'm thinking of, you know, what are the people who died? What would they be thinking? They think this makes sense for us to be in this kind of thing where you ride down the street and someone has a sign saying F so-and-so, or, I mean, it's not who we are.
So, you know, I'm not one who would join in some sort of F Biden chant. I don't, especially at a sporting event. I want my sporting events to not be political. But you could tell the liberals were upset because they were trying to say that this was, conservative hypocrisy. Some people were tweeting, don't be disrespectful to the flag by taking a knee at a football game, they said. Brought to you by the same people that think it's all right to chant F Joe Biden at a football game. Yeah, I'm really not for either one of those. But there's a difference between the solemnity of the national anthem, which is supposed to be a unifying moment, and then people booing or cursing at a politician. I mean, it's actually kind of customary in a lot of occasions when a president or a leader comes out to throw the first pitch or something. There's going to be some people that want to do the protest thing, and that's America. I'm not wild about chanting the F-bomb at the president, but it's funny that here we are in a day where it's supposed to be about other people, and Biden's just babbling about how he doesn't like F. Biden signs. It's like, today's not supposed to be about you. If you're saying, hey, this is I'm deliberately staying in the background today, you weren't really doing that. So there are some of these clips. Our Jorge Bonilla, MRC Latino, Twitter, at Bonilla, B-O-N-I-L-L-A-J-L. He was spreading some of these Biden clips. Then there was another one where he was talking about the actual withdrawal from Afghanistan. And he tried this whole line that we've seen all over the cable news from the Biden people, which is, this was always going to be messy.
If you had told anybody that we were going to spend $300 million a day for 20 years to try to unite the country after we got bin Laden, after Al-Qaeda was wiped out there, can Al-Qaeda come back? Yeah, but guess what? It's already back other places. What's the strategy? Every place where Al-Qaeda is, we're going to invade and have troops stay there? Come on. Anyway, so I just think that, and again, what people are, as I read it, I'm told, people, 70% of American people think it was time to get out of Afghanistan spending all that money. But the flip of it is, they didn't like the way we got out. But it's hard to explain to anybody how else could you get out. For example, if we were in Tajikistan, we pulled up a C-130 and said, we're going to let anybody who was involved with being sympathetic to us to get in the plane. You'd have people hanging the wheel well.
So people literally fell to their deaths from wheel wells, 19-year-old kids, and he's reaching for that to defend himself? It's just, this to me is a mess. This is exactly the kind of thing where they feel like they have to clean up from behind him like he's a circus elephant. You can't say that this was inevitable. You can certainly second guess the way this was done, that you could have done it differently. CNN actually ran this quote, this soundbite, several times on Saturday. So there's that people could actually see it. They weren't hiding it, but they weren't really saying, yikes. There was this one moment where Jim Acosta's interviewing Leon Panetta and he plays it. And you can tell what the professional politicians would say. Leon Panetta's answer to this was,
Secretary Panetta, you heard the president's comments there. We did see people hanging onto those cargo planes coming out of Afghanistan. Do you think the president should have gone there today and talked about, you know, some of the concerns that Americans had about the way we pulled out of Afghanistan?
I really think it's important for President Biden to move on. He made a decision. Whether you agree or disagree with the decision, he made it.
Like, you are on the wrong topic, pal, and you are not saying the right thing at all. On Sunday, Nick Nitrane Fondacaro found a clip from Face the Nation on CBS about the Biden vaccine mandates. Scott Gottlieb said that the mandate will harden positions and make this thing political. Well, look, there's no way at this point that COVID is not political. But I think the liberals really want to try to say that everyone should be for a vaccine mandate and no one should ever oppose it. So kudos to Margaret Brennan for having this conversation with her regular guest.
Look, states can mandate vaccines. Federal government has never done something like this before outside of the U.S. military. The Republican governor of Arkansas is on TV today saying this is going to backfire. He's trying to convince his constituents to take the vaccine, and because the federal government's telling them to, he says it's going to be even harder. Practically speaking, does this mandate make sense?
I think the downside of this mandate in terms of hardening positions and taking something that was subtly political and making it overtly political could outweigh any of the benefits that we hope to achieve.
So Gottlieb is a Republican and he ran the FDA under Trump, but he's been a Face the Nation regular despite all that. So, you know, again, that's a little bit surprising, but I think Gottlieb was willing to criticize Trump despite having worked for him. And of course, they always like that better. Then there's Vivek Murthy, the Surgeon General under Biden. He's a Democrat, and you could tell from what he said on ABC.
But what we cannot allow, George, is for this pandemic to turn us on each other. Our enemy is the virus. It is not one another. And what we have to do is approach this next phase of the pandemic response, recognizing we've got to listen to each other before we rush to judgment. We've got to support one another in our decision making and during times of crisis.
So this sounds like you need to bow down and support Biden because we have to support one another. Was that ever the take under Trump? You know, which medical expert who was all over CNN or MSNBC was saying, you know, I could criticize Trump, but we really need to support one another. It's important to note, Dr. Murthy is a Democrat. He gave several donations, adding up to $1,500, to a man named Raja Krishnamurthy, who became a congressman from the Chicago area. Oh, but then there's this from opensecrets.org. Quote, Murthy, a doctor at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and a Harvard Medical School instructor, is best known as the founders of Doctors for America, a physician advocacy organization that campaigned for the Affordable Care Act.
The organizations that are represented here today, the Doctors for America.
So the current Surgeon General, you want to say he's just getting up there to speak the science, but he was Doctors for Obamacare.
Thank you.
The article continues, quote, however, that organization started in 2008 with a different name and mission. Doctors for Obama worked to elect Obama. It relaunched in 2009. On its website, Doctors for America described itself as, quote, not affiliated with any partisan group or with the administration, and does not endorse or support any candidates or groups. Oh, sure. Well, when you were founded as Doctors for Obama, and then you're campaigning for Obamacare, really, saying you're not affiliated with the administration, who's buying that?
The Doctors for America?
Reporters wouldn't buy that.
Thank you.
The Open Secrets article noted, according to its website, though, the organization was fiscally supported by the Center for American Progress. If you're not aware of that, that is basically a think tank section of the Democratic Party. It was staffed with a bunch of people that worked for the Clintons. So obviously, you know, when you see Dr. Murthy on CNN or ABC and he's trying to say, we should really be less political, you can know that that's political. Then on Reliably Liberal, Reliably Sources on Sunday on CNN, host Brian Stelter took up the California recall. You know, he approaches California the typical way. He's there to bring Trump into it and warn that the far right isn't going to accept the election results, just like Trump has trouble accepting the national election results.
He plans to reverse all of the state's progress on immigrant rights and racial justice, and that he poses a very real threat to communities of color for all of the reasons that we've reported in the past.
Clearly, the LA Times opinion folks, you and others, have been very much against Elder. We will see what impact, if any, of that has had in 2 days. I like the word you used about Elder and the media, his performance. He performs his anti-media pose when he's on Fox and elsewhere. Because, of course, that's what we hear from the former president as well.
Now, obviously, the math is going to come in here. If this election isn't close, if they end up with 60% of the people voting against the recall of Gavin Newsom, then it's going to be hard to claim that it was too close to call in some way. The real point here that Stelter isn't going to talk about is that the Democrats in California send mail-in ballots to everyone, which makes it very tempting to cheat. But the Democrats obviously think this is a strategy, some sort of magic bullet to make sure they win elections. And then they run around and say, as they normally do, you have to support our election rules and our election regime because Democrats equal democracy. I mean, look, here's a piece of the New York Times last week that sort of underlines the point that the mail-in ballot rules can be criticized as a Democratic plot. Quote, a temporary change in California's election rules aimed at protecting voters during the coronavirus pandemic could be instrumental in Governor Gavin Newsom's effort to beat back a proposed recall. See, the New York Times is admitting the mail-in balloting rules were put in by the Democrats to put in a Democratic advantage. It continues, quote, because of the coronavirus, lawmakers ensured that ballots would automatically be mailed to every registered active voter, turning an already popular option into the default through at least the end of this year. As a result, political experts tracking returns in the recall are predicting that at least 50% of registered voters will cast ballots, roughly double the turnout that would be expected in a special election. So this is where you always worry. If you're supporting the governor that in a recall, you'd say the people who want to recall the governor are the most activated voters. They are the ones that succeeded in putting the recall on the ballot. You're going to assume that the supporters of the governor are not going to be as passionate as the opponents of the governor. Well, this is the way the Democrats are in general. I mean, let's continue with this article. They turn to David Townsend, a Sacramento-based Democratic political consultant. You cannot overstate how important the mail-in ballot will be in this election, said Townsend. Because Democrats outnumber Republicans by 2-1 in California, the electoral math is with Newsom, but only if his voters cast their ballots. Voting by mail gives even indifferent voters a nudge and an opportunity to cast a ballot without much effort. Townsend said, before this, you had to convince a voter to get in a car, drive to a location with no real signage but a flag, and go vote on something they might care about or might not. Now you get a ballot in the mail, you make an X by a box, sign it, and drop it back in the mailbox. You don't even have to look for a stamp. See, this is what Democrats do. They really have this idea that their voters are the laziest people imaginable. That you can't get them to do anything. That you can't, that putting a stamp on the envelope is just too much to expect from them. So this is the kind of thing that the CNN people are not going to acknowledge. Then it was also typical for Brian Stelter to slime Larry Elder, who is leading the candidates who would replace Larry Elder or replace Gavin Newsom. Elder is this self-loathing black man, according to Stelter. He's quote-unquote performing for white audiences on Fox News.
He's essentially been running his campaign on Fox News and on right-wing media outlets. He's refused to talk to large, you know, to nonpartisan and media outlets and to journalists who are critical of him. Has refused to answer difficult questions. Often uses the few interviews that he does give as an opportunity to give a performance on social media. You know, denouncing those journalists and playing the victim. But he has been able to reach the minority of voters in California who embrace his white supremacist worldview.
This is their way of just saying, this is a guy who loathes his own skin and is willing to cast his lot with people they think are white supremacists. They sort of smear the entire conservative electorate with that. Stelter, for this segment, brought on Will Bunch, who's this columnist who thinks Reagan was one of our worst presidents ever. Stacking the deck, are we? And then there's Los Angeles Times columnist Gene Guerrero, who likes to compare Elder to David Duke.
And, you know, he's co-opted this line by my fellow columnist from the headline, you know, calling him the black face of white supremacy. But he refuses to engage with the actual substance of our reporting. You know, the idea that his views were shaped by a well-known white supremacist named Jared Taylor, who he repeatedly quoted in early writings.
Stelter never asks her to explain herself on that one, not on the Sunday show and not on the 31-minute podcast he had with her a couple weeks ago. Stelter and Guerrero in this segment also ignored the, what liberals would call it, a hate crime, where a white woman wearing a gorilla mask threw an egg at Elder's head. This was something that you don't really discuss on CNN. They say facts first, but as usual, there are certain facts that just aren't worth talking about. Speaking of CNN and race, the website Red State notes that CNN columnist John Blake wrote this really weird piece about, quote, white supremacy with a tan, unquote. This is their way of trying to explain Larry Elder. Blake writes, the assumption that more racial diversity equals more racial equality is a dangerous myth. Racial diversity can function as a cloaking device, concealing the most powerful forms of white supremacy while giving the appearance of racial progress. Racism will likely be just as entrenched in a browner America as it is now. It will still be white supremacy with a tan. See, what that means is that when you don't support the Black Lives Matter agenda down to every tittle and jot, then you're not really black. This is the way it plays. So now you're white supremacy with a tan. If you're a black conservative, if you're a black who's ever voted Republican, then you're white supremacist. You don't know it maybe, but you are. And so Blake writes, whiteness is elastic. You can identify as white. So apparently now the black conservatives are like transracial. They're identifying as white people, except they're not. They're basically saying I'm black people with a different opinion. So Blake continues, white supremacy isn't just more resilient than many assume. It's also elastic. Consider how whiteness has been defined. It's a prime example of how white supremacy adapts. The census suggests white Americans will be a minority by 2045, but as several commentators have already noted, that date can easily be postponed. Whiteness isn't a fixed identity. It's like taffy. It expands to accommodate new members if they have the right look. Then he goes on to make this whole point That we, you know, you, it used to be considered that the Irish and the Italians weren't really white. You know, they did have side signs saying Irish need not apply. I mean, that was more anti-immigrant than anti-white. I mean, it is kind of funny to me, because if you know Irish people, especially that stereotype of like the Lucky Charms leprechaun Irish people, those are white people. There's no white supremacy with a tan for those people because they don't tan. They just burn in the sun like my boy Ben. But anyway, there is some truth to this idea that whiteness is, you know, has a tan, in that black leftists want to define blackness as leftist. If you're not leftist, then you're not black.
If you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, then you ain't black.
If you're not down with the left, you're somehow white. We learned this 30 years ago with Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas was somebody that they always presumed, if you're not in the quote-unquote interests of the community, and they always define this as the Democrat Party agenda, if you're not down with that, if you're concerned, like Larry Elder is, with black-on-black crime, you know, to be concerned at all about black-on-black crime is somehow anti-black. How does it make you less black to be concerned about black-on-black crime? But this is where the knee jerks on the black left. It's that whole idea of, well, if you say the kind of stuff that Sean Hannity does or David Duke does about black-on-black crime, like you make an argument about that, like that's worse than what the cops do, because it is. Mathematically, it is. Well, then you just, your knee jerks and you're like, well, if you make the same argument, then you're not black anymore. I get a kick out of this, so we're wrapping up here with the John Blake article. He turns to an expert named Eduardo Bonilla Silva. His book is called Racism Without Racists, Colorblind Racism and the Persistence of Racial Inequality in America. You know, part of this is just a matter of differences, and that is there will probably always be racial inequality. Liberals act like inequality is something that can be banished. Like, you can't have inequality of income. You can't have inequality between races if you start doing statistics. That you can't always have inequality between men and women. Now, obviously, there are certain measures there where you can say there's discrimination, and we've worked on that. There's an idea of racial justice. It's certainly, you can certainly argue that it's not fair, you know, what happened to George Floyd. You can make those arguments. But the whole problem here is they've set up a goal that's really kind of impossible to abolish in inequality. But I just get the whole idea, just the title, Racism Without Racists. That just kills me. Anyway, this author says, the apparent blessing of quote-unquote not seeing race will become a curse for those struggling for racial justice in years to come. And John Blake adds, you can no longer fight racism if everyone believes their country has moved past race. And so, yeah, that's what you end up with. And that is, we have networks in this country, of journalists in this country, that are never satisfied, that every moment of racial progress you might think you have made means nothing. So electing Obama means nothing, and so on and so forth. They're just going to always move the ball, and they're going to perpetually say that anybody who opposes their agenda is racist. And then they wonder, gee, why does nobody trust the media? Why are our numbers in the toilet? Why are our ratings on CNN and reliable sources so bad? Well, maybe because you're constantly insulting people. That when Larry Elder says something that conservatives think makes sense, you call him white supremacy with a black face. And Brian Stelter says, the conservatives argue with bad faith. This is why we're here. We're here to identify, expose, and correct liberal media bias, as we said in a book way long ago. We are the Media Research Center. We are Newsbusters, and you come to us once, twice, 24 times a day. Check us out, and thanks for listening.